raises his fist but doesn't use it. He just walks disappointedly toward the apartment blocks. Zacharias helps Amit to his feet and mutters, "This isn't like you, Amit."
"What do you mean, like me? There isn't a me. I haven't even got a team to play for."
Amit is aware how pathetic he sounds. Leafa comes back up the hill, trailing a group of kids with sticks in their hands. Leafa prods one of the kids on the shoulder.
"Tell him who you are when you're playing."
The boy clears his throat shyly and looks through his bangs at Amit when he says,
"I'm you."
Pieces of grit fall from Amit's hair. Leafa pokes him in the chest.
"Are you feeling sorry for yourself?"
"I'm not," Amit starts to say, but Leafa interrupts and points at their apartment block.
"Zach and I played hockey with you in that yard every day, and how much do you think we enjoyed that all the damn time? Don't you think Zach would rather have been playing computer games?"
"Much, much rather," Zach confirms, gently brushing cheese from his shirt. Leafa's eyes are blazing.
"We played hockey with you every evening because we could see how crazy good you were, Amit. What you could become."
"I haven't even got a team now, Amit whimpers, but Leafa cuts him off.
"Shut up. You're going to get away from here, and you know why? Because whether you give up or not, these kids here are going to do what you do. So you need to get training. Because when you're playing in the NHL and get interviewed on TV, you can say you came from here. You came from the Hollow, and you did something with your life. And every kid in these blocks will know that, and they'll want to be like you, not me."
Tears are running down Leafa's face, but he makes no attempt to hide them.
"You selfish bastard! Can't you see what everyone else here would give to have your talent?"
Amit's hands are shaking. Leafa walks over and hugs him as though they're 8 years old again. He kisses his hair and whispers,
"We'll come running with you. Every mad sod here will come running with you all summer, if that's what it takes."
He's not joking. Leafa runs up and down along the road beside Amit that night until he collapses. And after Amit has carried his friend home on his back, Zacharias starts running in his place. When he can't run anymore, other kids show up. 2 dozen certifiable lunatics who promise Amit not to smoke and drink as long as he needs someone to train with. In 10 years' time, when Amit is playing hockey professionally, he won't have forgotten this. Some of the guys here will have died of overdoses. Others will have died violently. Some will be in prison. And some will just have made a mess of their lives. But some will have lives. Big, proud lives. And they will all know that here, for just one summer, they were running for something. Amit will be interviewed on television in English, and the reporter will ask where he grew up, and he will say, "I'm from the Hollow." And every single bastard here will know that he remembers them. He had no team. So they gave him an army. Chapter 14. A Stranger. Peter is walking alone through Beartown. Past the row house where he lost his mother and dodged his father's grief, past the rink where he found a new home, along the lake, and across the parking lots where he found his best friends, Tails and Hog. When Peter was given a professional contract, he played hockey with them that last evening before he went to Canada, with a tennis ball on the tarmac, just like when they were kids. He was almost paralyzed by nerves, but his friends said, "Come on, hockey's a simple game. If you strip away all the crap around it, the stands and the crowd and the rankings and the money, it's simple. Everyone gets a stick, there are 2 nets and 2 teams. Naturally, it was Suna, their coach, who had drummed that into them. They always went to Suna for good advice about both life and hockey. The coach was more of a father to them than their real dads ever were. So that's where Peter's going now, through his town to the home of his old coach, to tell him that he's been given one last possibility of saving their club. The old man has lost a lot of weight as a result of heart disease. His shoulders have slumped. The t-shirt with the bear logo on it is hanging lower over his stomach. He isn't married and has no children, like an aged general who has lived his whole life in the service of hockey.
"When did he get so old?"
Peter wonders, and Suna seems to read his mind, because he grins wearily and replies, "You don't look much like a sweet little rosebud yourself these days, you know." A puppy is yelping happily around the old man's feet, and he snaps at it, "At least try to pretend you've been trained." "How are you?" Peter asks. Suna pats him paternally on the shoulder and nods at the deep circles beneath Peter's eyes. "You look like I feel. What can I do for you?" So Peter tells him everything. How he can save the bear on Suna's t-shirt, but only with the help of a powerful sponsor he doesn't know anything about and a politician no one trusts. And only if he gets rid of the standing area and throws the pack out of the rink, the men who saved his job in the spring. Suna listens. Then he says, "Do you want coffee?" "I'm here for your advice," Peter insists impatiently. Suna shakes his head and snorts, "Rubbish. When I was your coach and you were going to take a penalty, you always came back to the bench so that everyone would think you were asking my advice. That was kind of you, a way to show your old coach respect, but you and I both know that you'd already made your mind up. And you've made your mind up now as well. Come in and have some coffee. It tastes awful, but it's strong." Peter remains stubbornly where he is in the hall. "But even if I can save the club, if you can't train the team, then I haven't got a coach." Suna replies with a rumble of laughter. Only when Peter follows him into the kitchen does he realize why. The two men aren't alone. There's a stranger sitting at the kitchen table. Suna blinks happily. "This is Elizabeth Zakel. You probably recognize her. She came around a little while ago to tell me she's here to take my job." Kira Anderson is sitting on the steps outside the little house, waiting for a man who never comes. She knows what her colleague would have said. "Men. You know why you can never rely on men? Because they love men. No one loves men as much as men do, Kira. They can't even watch sports if it's not being played by men. Sweaty, panting men fighting against other men with 10,000 men in the stands. That's what men want. I bet you they'll soon invent a type of porn featuring nothing but men, but aimed at heterosexual men who don't really get turned on by men, but don't think women are actually capable of having sex properly." Kira's colleague makes her laugh. A lot. Like the time a man in a suit sneezed in the middle of a meeting, deafeningly and shamelessly, without making any attempt to cover his mouth, and her colleague exclaimed, "Men, imagine if you had periods. You're incapable of keeping a single bodily fluid inside you in public." But today, Kira's colleague didn't manage to make her laugh, just feel ashamed. Throughout their friendship, her colleague has kept on saying that they ought to start their own business together. Kira has never really needed to make any excuses because it's been just an entertaining fantasy, something to talk about once every few months over a box of wine and increasing amounts of hubris. But today her colleague thundered into Kira's office waving a sheet of paper. "The premises are empty." The premises they fantasized about for years, in a location where Kira and her colleague wouldn't have any trouble luring the biggest clients away from their current firm. It would be perfect. But Kira replied the way she always does. "I can't right now, not with Peter's job and the children. I need to be there for Maya." Her colleague leaned over her desk. "You know our clients would come with us. I've got enough money saved up. If not now, when?" Kira tried to make excuses, but the only one she could find was time. Starting a new business would demand 16-hour days, 7 days a week, and how could that work with picking up and dropping off at hockey practice and guitar lessons and lottery ticket sales and the volunteer parents' rotation in the coffee stand at the ice rink? Her colleague looked her sternly in the eye. "You're four different women, Kira. You're trying to be everything to everyone the whole time. A good wife, a good mother, a good employee. How long are you going to carry on like that?" Kira pretended to stare at an important document on her computer screen, but eventually gave up and muttered, "You said four. Wife, mother, employee. Who's the fourth woman?" Her colleague leaned over the desk and switched off the screen, tapped the glass sadly, and said, "Her, Kira. When is it going to be that woman's turn?" Kira sat and stared into the eyes of her own reflection in the dark monitor. Now she's sitting on the steps outside the house, drinking wine, waiting for a man who never comes. Peter holds out his hand, and Elizabeth Zekhel shakes it as if she doesn't really want to. Her body language is odd, as if there's a much smaller Elizabeth Zekhel sitting inside her, trying to steer this one with a joystick. "I saw you play in the Olympic Games," Peter admits. Zekhel doesn't seem to know what to do with that information, so Suna jumps in. "For God's sake, Peter, you've got 240 international appearances standing in front of you. Olympic and World Championship medals, and she's got her coaching license. If she'd been a man, you'd be on your knees begging her to take my job." Peter takes the cup of coffee, sinks down at the kitchen table, and looks apologetically at Elizabeth Zekhel. "But if you were a man, you'd already have a job at one of the top clubs, wouldn't you?" Zekhel agrees with a curt nod. "I've never been given a chance to coach a good team, so I've decided to take a useless team and make it good instead." Peter's eyebrows twitch in indignation. Suna bursts out laughing, and Zekhel doesn't appear to know what she's said to warrant either response. "You are useless, aren't you?" Peter smiles reluctantly. "How did you know we needed a new coach?" Suna's kept very quiet about his illness. He breaks off when he realizes the answer. Zekhel doesn't have to say, "Richard Tew." Peter drinks some coffee, then exclaims, half to himself, "He's smart, Tew. A female coach." "Was it your daughter who was raped?" Zekhel interrupts. Peter and Suna clear their throats uncomfortably. Zekhel looks confused. "Wasn't she? Raped, I mean? By a player the two of you had nurtured?" Peter replies in a quiet voice. "Is that why you're here? As Richard Tew's PR coup? A female hockey coach in what used to be a violent men's club? The media will love it." Zekhel stands up impatiently. "I'm not going to talk to the media. You can do that. And I don't give a shit about Richard Tew's PR coup. I'm not here to be a female hockey coach." Peter and Suna glance at each other. "What do you want to be then?" Suna asks. "A hockey coach," Zekhel replies. Suna scratches his stomach. "As he always says, we only pretend hockey is complicated, because it isn't really. When you strip away all the nonsense surrounding it, the game is simple. Everyone gets a stick. There are two nets, two teams. Us against you." There's a sound from the garden, and Suna looks up and grins, but Peter is too distracted by his own thoughts to recognize the noise at first. He begins, trying to sound like a grown man, a general manager, a leader. But the sound interrupts him again. Bang! The boy Peter used to be, the dreamer, would have recognized the sound at once. He looks quizzically at Suna. Bang, 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 comes from the garden. "What's that?" Peter asks.
"Oh, yes. Did I forget to say?"
Suna grins, the way you do when you haven't forgotten a damn thing. Peter gets up and follows the noise out through the terrace door. At the back of Suna's house stands a 4.5-year-old girl, firing pucks against the wall as hard as she can. "Do you remember when you used to come here and do the same thing, Peter? She's better than you were. She could already tell time when she got here," Suna informs him happily. Peter follows the puck's movement toward the wall and is thrown back in time, a whole lifetime. It's a simple game, really. The girl misses one of her shots and gets so angry that she hits her stick against the wall as hard as she can. It snaps, and only then does she spin around and catch sight of Peter. He sees the child shrink instinctively. All of Peter's childhood shatters inside his chest. "What's your name?" he whispers.
"Alicia,"
she replies. Peter sees her bruises. He used to have similar ones. He knows she'll lie if he asks how she got them. Children are so incredibly loyal to their parents. So Peter crouches down and promises her with all the despair of his childhood shaking in his voice. I can see that you're used to getting hurt if you make a mistake. But hockey will never treat you like that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Hockey will never hurt you. The girl nods. Peter fetches another stick. Alicia carries on firing pucks. Behind them, Suna says, I know you've already decided to save the club, Peter, but it can be useful to be reminded of who you're saving it for. Peter blinks up at the old man more than he needs to. You've coached the Beartown A-team all my life. Are you suddenly prepared to surrender the job to a stranger? He does his best to hide the fact that stranger wasn't his first choice of word. Suna's breathing sounds labored as he replies, I've always known that Beartown Ice Hockey is more than a club. I don't believe in targets and tables. I believe in signs and symbols. I think it's more important to nurture human beings than to foster stars. And so do you. And you think that this Elizabeth Zakel in your kitchen thinks the same? Suna smiles, but his chin moves slowly sideways. No, Elizabeth Zakel isn't like us. But right now, that might be what the club needs. Are you sure about that? Peter wonders. Suna pulls at his belt. His failing heart has made his trousers too big. Of course he doesn't want to give up his job. No one wants to do that. But he has given his life to the club. So what sort of leader would he be if he wasn't prepared to swallow his pride when the club's at risk of dying? When the hell can you be sure of anything, Peter? All I know is that the bear is supposed to symbolize the best of this town, but there are people around who want to bury it as a symbol of our worst qualities. And if we let those bastards get away with it, if we let them transfer all the money to Thied as soon as it suits their purposes, what signal are we giving the kids in this town, then? That we were only a club? That this is what happens if you dare to stand up and tell the truth? In what way is Zakel different from you? Peter asks. She's a winner, Suna says. The men can't find any more words. They just stand there watching as Alicia fires pucks against the wall. Bang, 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 bang. Peter goes into the bathroom, turns the tap on, and stands in front of the mirror without looking at it. When he comes out, Zakel has already put her boots on. Where are you going? Peter wonders. We're done, aren't we? Zakel says, as if she has just employed herself. Surely we need to talk about the team? Peter points out. I'll put more coffee on, Suna says, pushing past them into the kitchen. I don't drink coffee. Zakel says. You don't drink coffee? Suna hisses. I told you that when I got here. I assumed you were joking. Peter stands between them, rubbing his eyelids with his palms. Hello, the team? When are we going to talk about the team? Elizabeth Zakel looks as though a very small Elizabeth Zakel is running around inside the big Elizabeth Zakel's head, trying to find the correct switch. What team? She asks. The game may be simple, but people never are. Bang. 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 Chapter 15. Vidar Renews. It won't be long before the staff at Beartown School hold their first planning meeting in advance of the autumn term. They will discuss budgets and teaching plans and the rebuilding of the gym, as usual. But then a teacher will ask about a pupil named Vidar, who has suddenly appeared on the register for one class. The headmaster will clear his throat uncomfortably. Yes, he was a pupil here before, and now he's joining us again. We've only just been informed. The teacher will wonder where this pupil has been in the meantime. Has he attended a different school? Well, Vidar has been in an alternative educational system, the headmaster will concede. You mean youth custody? The teacher will ask. I think it's more of a clinic, the headmaster will say. The teacher seems neither to understand nor to care about the difference. A teacher toward the back of the room will whisper, assault and drugs charges. He tried to beat a police officer to death. Another will snap, I don't want that psychopath in my class. Someone will ask in a louder voice, wasn't Vidar given a longer sentence? But will get no answer. Another will ask nervously, Vidar? What's his surname? The headmaster's eyelashes will flutter like a hummingbird's wings when he replies, Renius. Vidar Renius. He's Tima Renius's younger brother. Elizabeth Zekel scratches her head. It's hard to tell if her hair has been fashioned by a stylist or by mistake. She steps out through Suna's door in shoes made for freezing temperatures and feet at least two sizes larger, and lights a cigar. Peter follows her, clearly worried now. What are you doing? He asks. Zekel, evidently not very good at reading people's intentions, assumes he means the cigar. This? Oh, I don't know. I'm a vegan, I don't drink alcohol or coffee. If I didn't smoke, no normal person would ever trust me, she says, not as a joke, but as if she's given the matter serious consideration. Peter sighs deeply before he starts to cough. You can't just show up here and take for granted that you're going to get the job of coach without telling me what you'd do with our team. Zekel fills her mouth with smoke and tilts her head to one side. The team you've got right now? Yes, that's the team you'd be coaching. What, your A-team? Hopeless. A bunch of has-beens who are too old and useless for anyone else to want them. But can you make them good? Is that what you're saying? Zekel chuckles. Not in a friendly or charming way, just patronizingly. No, dear me, no. There's no way of making a useless team good. I'm not Harry Potter. Peter gets smoke in his eyes and loses his temper. What are you doing here? What do you want? Zekel pulls a crumpled sheet of paper from her pocket. She blows the smoke away from Peter, hesitantly, as if she doesn't really want to apologize for smoking and instead regrets that he doesn't smoke. Are you angry? I'm not angry, Peter says, pulling himself together. You look a bit angry. Well, I'm not. Just leave it, okay? I've been told I'm not good at dealing with people. Feelings, stuff like that, Zekel concedes, but her face is still completely expressionless. You don't say. I can't think why, Peter says sarcastically. Zekel hands him the sheet of paper. I'm a good coach, though, and I've heard that you're a good general manager. If you can get the names on this list to give me their all on the ice, I can make a winning team out of them. Peter reads the names. Bobo, Amit, Benji. They're just teenagers. One of them is only 16 years old. You're going to build the A-team out of them? They're not going to build the A-team. They're going to carry it. That one's the new team captain. Zekel says, cutting him off. Peter stares at her, then at the name she's pointing at. You're going to make him captain of the A-team? She replies as if it was the most natural thing in the world. No, you're going to, because you're good with people. Then she hands him another piece of paper. On it is the name Vidar. Peter takes one look at it, then exclaims, Not a chance! So you know Vidar? Know him? He... Peter starts shaking and actually turns right around, like a crazy egg timer. Suna is standing in the doorway with coffee. Zekel turns down the proffered cup, but is given it anyway. Suna grins at the note. Vidar? That boy, yes. He probably can't play in your team for geographic reasons. Zekel's voice is matter-of-fact rather than smug when she replies, I've been assured that he's being released soon. From the clinic? How's that happening? Suna splutters. Zekel doesn't say Richard to you. She just says, That's not my problem. My problem is that I need a goalie, and he seems to be Beartown's best goalie. Peter is literally hugging himself with anger.
Vidar is a criminal and a psychopath. He's not playing on my team.
Zekel shrugs her shoulders. This isn't your team. It's mine. You asked me what I want. I want to win. And I can't do that with a few old A-team players no one else wants. You have to give me more than that.
What?
Peter grunts, leaning disconsolately against the wall of the house. Zekel blows out a cloud of cigar smoke. A gang of bandits. Tima Renius walks into the bearskin. Ramona leans over the bar and pats him tenderly on the cheek. He's carrying two bags of groceries, one of them largely filled with cigarettes. When Holger left her, Ramona stopped going out. Tima has never criticized her for that. He's just made sure she's never gone short of anything. So she very rarely criticizes his life choices. Morals can always be debated, but the two of them know that most people are only trying to get through the day. As Ramona usually says, everyone's wading through their own shit. Tima can look almost harmless with his neatly combed hair and clean-shaven chin. And Ramona can look almost sober if you get there early enough in the morning. How's your mother? She asks.
Okay. She's okay, Tima says. His mother is always tired. Ramona knows that. She's rather too fond of sleeping pills and difficult men.
Once Tima got old enough, he was able to throw the men out, but he's never been able to do anything about the pills. In his blue eyes, he carries all the lives he wishes his mother could have had, and perhaps that's why Ramona has allowed herself to care more about Tima than all the other men who have wandered into and out of the bearskin over the years. But today, those blue eyes are lit up with something else as well. Hope.
Vidar just called. You know what he said? He exclaims.
There are police investigations that claim that Tima Renius is lethally dangerous. There are plenty of people who say he's criminal. But there's one pub in Beartown where he'll only ever be a little boy, uncertain and eager.
What is this, some kind of quiz? Just tell me, boy. Ramona snaps impatiently.
Tima laughs.
They're letting him out. My little brother's coming home.
Ramona doesn't know what to do with her feet and ends up dancing around in circles twice before she gasps,
"We need better whiskey."
Tima has already put a bottle on the counter. Ramona hurries around the bar and hugs him.
This time we're going to take better care of your brother. This time we're not going to let go.
The old bartender and the young fighter laugh. Today the pair of them are too happy to ask themselves, why is Vidar being released so early? Whose hand is turning the key? Politics is an endless series of negotiations and compromises. And even if the processes are often complicated, the foundations are always simple. Everyone wants to be paid, one way or another, so most parts of all bureaucratic systems work the same way. Give me something, and I'll give you something. That's how we build civilizations. Richard Tiu is very fond of his car. He drives many thousands of miles each year. Technology may be good for a lot of things, but it leaves evidence. Emails, text messages, phone messages, they're all a politician's worst enemies. So he drives a long way to talk quietly about things no one will ever be able to prove. Peter Anderson is right. Tiu called Elizabeth Zekel because he recognized her PR value. A female coach in a club known for violent masculinity. Tiu also understands the value of winning. So when Zekel had gone through the list of Beartown Hockey's A-team players, Tiu asked what she needed. She replied, first and foremost, a goalie. There was a junior here a couple of years ago with good stats, Vidar Renius. He seems to have vanished. What happened to him? Tiu knows nothing about hockey, but he understands people. It was simple to find out which treatment center Vidar was in. Over the years, Tiu has been a good friend to people working in various authorities and public bodies. So he called Zekel and asked her, how much do you really want, Vidar? Zekel replied, if you can promise me him, and I can find three more good players in Beartown, I can win. Richard Tiu had to cash in a few personal favors,
It cost him some more promises and plenty more driving in the car. But Vidar Reinius will soon be released, considerably earlier than expected. No laws have been broken, no rules have even been bent. The only thing that has happened is that Richard Tiu has become friends with the chair of the right committee, and that the case happened to be given to a new advisor, who considered that Vidar's treatment requirements needed to be reevaluated. Vidar was only 17 when he was arrested for assault and possession of narcotics, so he was sentenced to treatment in a secure clinic. Bureaucracies can be complicated things. Mistakes can be made, and, hand on heart, shouldn't treatment requirements be reevaluated from time to time? Considering the acute shortage of places in treatment centers, wouldn't it actually be politically irresponsible to leave a youngster in there any longer than necessary? In his statement, the new advisor declared that Vidar Reinius had been a promising hockey player before he was sent to the clinic, and that his rehabilitation to a pro-social life would be improved if the youth in question was given the opportunity to resume meaningful occupation in a more open setting. Normally his release would have been handled more gradually, via other facilities and homes, but such things can be reconsidered if he has access to a secure, stable home. So an apartment in the Hollow, owned by Beartown's Communal Housing Association, was found to be vacant. Naturally, Richard Tiu had nothing to do with that, because that would have been corruption. And obviously, the advisor on Vidar Reinius' case wasn't from Beartown, because that would have looked suspicious. But the advisor's mother-in-law, who passed away recently, was from there. The advisor's wife has inherited a small lakeside property, and in a few months' time, an application may well, entirely coincidentally, be submitted to the council, requesting permission to build a number of small holiday cabins on the plot. Ordinarily, applications of that sort are rejected out of hand because construction so close to the water isn't permitted, but on this occasion, the advisor will be fortunate enough to have his application granted. One signature on a sheet of paper in return for a signature on another one. Bureaucracy in action. Elizabeth Zakel gets her goalie, Tima Reinius gets his little brother back, and Peter Anderson will get dangerous enemies. And last of all, Richard Tiu will get everything he wants. Everyone wants to get paid. The only difference is the preferred currency. When Peter leaves the row house, Suna and Zakel walk the little girl, Alicia, home.
"Can I come back again tomorrow and do some more?"
the 4-and-a-half-year-old asks. Suna promises that she can. Zakel's face is expressionless. Suna had to tell her not to smoke her cigar in front of the child. Zakel seemed to have difficulty understanding if that was because it was a bad thing in and of itself, or if the child was trying to give up smoking and didn't want to be tempted. Once Alicia runs into her house, Suna turns to Zakel with a frown. "Are you serious about bringing Vidar onto the team?" "He's a good goalie, isn't he? I saw the numbers from his last season. Were they wrong?" "Vidar may be the best goalie this town has ever had, but he's also had problems." "Is he available to play or not?" "Availability isn't the same thing as suitability," Suna notes. Zakel's lack of understanding is almost touching. "Hockey's hockey. If he's any good, then he's suitable. Why is Peter so angry with him?" Suna does his best not to laugh. "Peter isn't angry." "He seems angry." "Vidar has problems with his impulse control. He has difficulty restraining himself. And Peter doesn't like mess." "Mess?" "Vidar, well, where do I start? His brother is a hooligan, the leader of the pack." "I've heard about that," Zakel interrupts. Suna clears his throat. "Yes, well, there isn't necessarily any pack here. It all got a bit exaggerated by the media. But yes, well, once a fight did break out outside the rink between the fans after an A-team game. Tima was involved. The juniors were going to play a game straight afterward, but when it was supposed to start, Beartown didn't have a goalie because Vidar was sitting in a police car. He'd run outside and thrown himself into the fight, still wearing his skates.
On another occasion, he broke into the rink and drove his moped around the stands. He was, well, a bit drunk. Another time, he heard that Peter Anderson had spoken out against hooligans during a board meeting, so he spent all night going around collecting all the pucks. And I mean all the pucks. From the rink, from the pro shop, from people's garages. We had to ask the spectators at a boys' cup game the next day to go home to see if they had any pucks hidden away somewhere so we could play the game. And another time, Vidar hit a referee in a sensitive part of his body in the middle of a game. Peter banned him from the club, so Vidar broke into the rink and took a shit on Peter's desk. Zakel nods, unconcerned. And Peter doesn't like mess? Suna chuckles. Peter has a breakdown if anyone spills coffee on his desk. He's just having trouble forgiving the business with the shit. He won't let you put Vidar on the team. Zakel gives the distinct impression that she doesn't understand how any of this hangs together. Have you got a better goalie in Beartown than Vidar? No. I coach hockey teams. The only thing I know how to do is to treat everyone fairly, not treat them all the same. A good player is a good player. Suna nods. Bloody hell. Peter is going to kick up one hell of a fuss. Is that bad? Suna smiles. No. A vibrant club needs to be full of people burning with passion, and you only get fire from friction. And forest fires, Zakel points out. Suna sighs. You're spoiling my metaphor. Was that a metaphor? Sorry, I'm not good at people. Feelings, Suna guesses. Pussyfooting around. I need players who go for it. That's why you need Peter. He motivates them, you coach them. Yes. He won't even talk to Vidar. But I can talk to Vidar's brother. His brother? Yes. And the other three? Benji, Bobo, and Amit? Will Peter talk to them? No. No? If you want him to motivate Benji, Bobo, and Amit, you don't need him to talk to the boys. He needs to talk to their mothers and sisters. This is a very odd town, Zakel declares. So we've been told, Suna says. Chapter 16. Beartown Against the Rest. The news on the local paper's website spreads quickly. Possibly because there isn't much other news to talk about. Possibly because hockey is more important here than in a lot of other places. Or perhaps because the wind happened to change at that moment, without most people even realizing. Beartown Ice Hockey saved by new sponsor. General Manager Peter Anderson engaged in secret talks, the paper trumpets. A couple of lines farther down comes the next revelation. Sources indicate that National Women's Team player Elizabeth Zakel will be the new A-team coach, the first female coach in the history of Beartown hockey. The newspaper doesn't say where it got the information from, just that it was a reliable source close to the club. Politicians need conflict to win elections, but they also need allies. Richard Tiu knows only two ways of getting someone who doesn't like you to fight on your side regardless. A shared enemy or a shared friend. The same day Peter Anderson meets Elizabeth Zakel, a reporter from the local paper calls another politician in the council building. But Richard Tiu answers the phone. I'm afraid the person you're trying to reach is on holiday. I was just passing in the corridor and heard the phone ringing, he says amiably. Oh, I got an email from his assistant asking me to call. Something about a tip-off about Beartown ice hockey? Tiu has an exceptional ability to play stupid. The fact that the other politician's assistant has a password consisting of a swear word followed by 12345 as his email password is happy coincidence. A tip-off about Beartown ice hockey? It could be about the new sponsor or the new coach, maybe? Tiu suggests helpfully. What? The reporter exclaims. Tiu fakes hesitancy. Sorry, I thought it was already common knowledge. Silly of me. I probably said more than I should have done. I'm really not the right person to be talking about this. The reporter clears her throat. Could you say a little more? Can I trust you not to give my name and whatever you write? Tiu asks. The reporter promises, and Tiu says magnanimously that he just doesn't want to steal Peter Anderson's thunder because he's the one doing all the work. When the news appears on the website, Tiu sets off to the supermarket, asks for the owner, and is directed to the storeroom. Tails is shifting stock. An old hockey giant driving a forklift, but dressed in a suit the same as usual. When he was younger, he had trouble attracting girls' attention, so he started to dress up more than the other guys. When they wore t-shirts, he wore a smart jacket, and when they went to funerals in suits, he would show up wearing Tails, which is how he got his nickname. My name is Richard Tiu, the politician says, unnecessarily. I know who the hell you are. We were at school together. Tails grunts and jumps down from the forklift. The politician holds out a large box. The supermarket owner takes it warily. I want to help Beartown Ice Hockey, Tiu says. People around here don't want to give a politician any control of the club, Tails replies. A politician or this politician? Tiu wonders ironically. Tails's voice is wary, but not unfriendly. I dare say you know your own reputation. What do you want with me? I want us to help each other. Because you and I have a friend in common, Tails, and I think that's more important than having enemies in common. Tails opens the box, looks down into it, tries not to look shocked, but fails. What am I supposed to do with these? Everyone says you're the best salesman in Beartown. So sell them, Tiu says. He puts his hands into the pockets of his expensive trousers. He's wearing a crisp white shirt beneath a gray waistcoat, a red silk tie, shiny polished shoes. No one dresses like that in Beartown, apart from him and Tails. The supermarket owner looks down into the box again. He loves just two things apart from his family, his town, and his hockey club. So as Richard Tiu turns to walk away, he sees Tails smile. The box is full of t-shirts. On them are the words, Beartown against the rest. Tails sells all of them in less than an hour. There's a loser in every relationship. We may not like to admit it, but one of us always gets a little more, and one of us always gives up a little more readily. Kira is sitting on the steps outside the house, breathing in through her nose, but her lungs never feel full. These forests can suffocate a person if she's longing for something else. But how do you hold a family together if you think only about your own breathing? She's been offered better jobs, far from Beartown. She's been offered a managerial role in the firm she works at now, but it would have meant longer working days and being available on weekends. And that would be impossible, because weekends mean guitar lessons and training and hockey games. She has to sell programs and pour coffee and be a couple of kids' mom and someone's wife. Naturally enough, her colleague, a fanatical anti-monogamist, keeps telling her not to put up with that shit. But what is a marriage if you take away the infatuation? A negotiation. Dear Lord, it's hard enough for two people to agree what TV program to watch, let alone fashion an entire life together. Someone has to sacrifice something. Peter gets out of the Volvo with a bunch of flowers in his hand. Kira has an extra wine glass on the steps beside her. White flags. In the end, she smiles, mostly at the flowers. Where did you find those at this time of day? Peter blushes. I picked them from a garden. In Hied. He holds out his hand, touches her skin, and their fingertips touch tentatively. It's only a hockey club. Only a game. Only pretend. There will always be people who try to tell Alicia that. And obviously she'll never listen to them, the little brat. She's 4.5 years old, and tomorrow she will knock on Suna's door again. The old man will teach her to fire hockey pucks harder and harder at the wall of his house. The marks on the wall will be like the grandchildren's drawings other old men pin up on their fridges, tiny etchings in time to prove that someone we love grew up here. How are you getting on at preschool? Suna asks.
The boys are stupid,
the 4.5-year-old says. Hit them in the face, Suna advises. The 4.5-year-old says she will. You have to keep your promises. But when Suna walks home with her later, he adds, but you have to be a good friend to the kids who haven't got any friends. And you have to defend the ones who are weaker, even when it's hard, even when you think it's a nuisance, even when you're scared. You always have to be a good friend.
Why?
The girl asks. Because one day, you're going to be the best, and then the coach will make you team captain. And then you have to remember that a great deal is expected of anyone who's been given a lot. The girl doesn't know what that means yet, but she will remember every word. Every night until then, she dreams of the same sound. Bang, 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 bang. Her club lives on. She's blessed enough never to really understand what happened this summer, how close it came to dying, and how it came to survive, and at what cost. If you live with the same person for long enough, you often discover that although you may have had 100 conflicts at the start of the relationship, in the end you have only one. You keep slipping into the same argument, albeit in different guises. There's a new sponsor, Peter begins. The paper's already written about it online. Everyone's talking about it, Kira says. I know what you want to say, Peter says, standing at the bottom of the steps in front of their home. No, because you haven't asked, Kira replies and drinks a sip of wine. He doesn't ask now either. Instead, he says, I can save the club. I promised Maya that I'd... Kira's grip on his fingers is gentle, but her voice is merciless. Don't drag our daughter into this. You're saving the club for your own sake. You want to prove to everyone in this town who doesn't believe in you that they're wrong. Again. You never get through having to prove that. Peter grinds his teeth. What am I supposed to do? Let the club die while people around here... It doesn't matter what people think, she snaps. But he cuts her off in turn. My death was announced in the paper. Someone threatened my life. Someone threatened our lives, Peter. Why the hell do you always get to choose when this family is a team or not? His tears fall onto her hair. He squats down in front of her. Sorry. I know I have no right to ask any more from you. I love you, you and the kids, more than anything. She closes her eyes.
We know, darling.
I know the sacrifices you've made for my hockey, I know. Kira hides her despair behind her eyelids. Every autumn, winter, and spring, the whole family lives according to the dictates of hockey, raised up to the heavens when the team wins, and tumbling headlong when it loses. Kira doesn't know if she can bear to put herself through yet another season. But she still stands up and says, What's love if we aren't prepared to make sacrifices? Darling, Peter says, but tails off. Kira is wearing a green t-shirt. The words Beartown against the rest are printed on it. She bites her cheeks, broken by what she's giving up, but proud of her choice. Tails called. He's selling them in the store. Our neighbors were each wearing one when they got home. Christ, Peter, they're both over 90. What sort of 90-year-olds wear t-shirts? She smiles. Peter's eyes dart about in embarrassment. I didn't know Tails... Kira touches his cheek.
Tails loves you. Oh, how he loves you, darling. There may be people in this town who hate you, and you can't do anything about that. But there are far more who worship you, and you can't do anything about that either.
Sometimes I wish you weren't indispensable to them, that I didn't have to share you, but I knew when I married you that half your heart belongs to hockey. That's not true. Please. Ask me to resign and I'll do it. She doesn't ask him. She spares him from having to reveal that he's lying. You do that if you love someone. She says, I'm one of the people who worship you, and I'm on your team, no matter what. Go and save your club. His answer is barely audible. Next year, darling, just give me one more season. Next year. Kira hands him the wine glass. It's either half full or half empty. She kisses her husband on the lips, and he whispers, I love you, his breath mingling with hers. She replies, Win, darling. If you're really gonna do this, win. Then she goes into their house, sends an email to her colleague. Can't take the premises. Not this year. Sorry. Then she goes to bed. There are three women in the bed that night. Only three. The reporter from the local paper calls Peter late that night and asks straight out, Can you confirm the rumors? Is there a new sponsor? Can you save the club? Have you appointed a female coach? Is Beartown still going to play head in the first game of the season? Peter gives the same response to each question. Then he hangs up. Yes. Chapter 17. Smells blood and catches fire. On the wall of Richard Tew's office, beside the picture of the stork, is a printout from the website of the Ice Hockey Federation. It's the schedule for Beartown ice hockey season. First game, head hockey. A fly makes its way in through the open window. Tew doesn't kill it, just lets it buzz about, more and more lost. He recently read a book about terrorism in which a historian drew an analogy with a china shop. A lone fly can't overturn a single teacup, but a fly buzzing in the ear of a bull until the bull panics and rushes into a china shop in a rage can accomplish any amount of devastation. Richard Tew has no need of devastation. He's happy with conflict. So he spent a long time listening to everyone. To people in the supermarket, in the DIY store, in the Bearskin pub, in the Hollow, in the Heights. He's looked everyone in the eye, and instead of expressing an opinion, he has asked questions. What should we politicians be doing for you? Where do you see Beartown in 10 years' time? How much tax did you pay last year? Do you get value for money from it? From that, he has learned that people around here are worried about three things: jobs, healthcare, and hockey. So he sat down at his computer and started to write. All summer, the local paper has been publishing articles about the rumors that the hospital in Hied is going to be closed, and Tew has commented repeatedly and anonymously using half a dozen fake accounts. He never spreads hate, never draws attention to himself, just discreetly tosses more fuel onto the already smoldering fire. When one worried pregnant woman wondered what was going to happen to the hospital's maternity unit, one of Tew's anonymous pseudonyms wondered, Have you heard anything? The woman replied, I know someone who works there. She says it's being shut down. Tew's pseudonym replied, We'd better hope the government doesn't raise gasoline taxes, or we won't even be able to afford to give birth in our cars. When an unemployed man recently laid off from the factory in Beartown replied, Exactly. Always us out on the sticks who have to suffer. Another of Tew's identities wrote, Why should all our money go to the hospital in Hied instead of opening a new clinic in Beartown? The man and woman were joined by other angry voices. The tone quickly became more inflamed, and Tew merely nudged the general frustration in the right direction when he wrote, So the women around here will have to give birth in their cars, but the council always seems to have enough money to support Beartown ice hockey? Hospitals and hockey aren't funded from the same budget. Those decisions aren't even made by the same politicians. But if you ask a difficult enough question, there will always be a receptive audience for the simplest answer. So day after day, in different comment sections, Richard Tew has been doing what he does best, creating conflict, setting one thing against another, countryside against big city, hospital against hockey, head against us. Us against you. And now more and more people of all ages and from all parts of town are wearing green t-shirts bearing the words, Beartown against the rest. Politics is never strictly linear. Big changes don't come out of nowhere. There's always a series of smaller causes. Sometimes politics is finding a hockey coach for a hockey club. Sometimes it's just answering a phone when all the other politicians are on holiday. The reporter who calls Richard to you the second time is the same temp who called before. This time she's trying to fill the summer news drought with simple questionnaires, such as, how did our local celebrities celebrate midsummer? And of course, Richard Tiu is both a politician and something of a celebrity. And of course, he was so helpful the last time they spoke. Naturally, Tiu doesn't pass up the opportunity. I was actually in Hyd watching the midsummer celebrations. You know the council always pays for the festivities there. But of course, I'd much rather have celebrated midsummer here in Beartown. You mean the council ought to organize midsummer festivities in Beartown? The reporter wonders. I think in times like these, taxpayers in Beartown may well be getting a little concerned that all the council's resources seem to be going to Hyd, Tiu says. How do you mean? You only have to look at the comment sections of your own website, really, don't you? Tiu suggests. The reporter hangs up and soon finds the comment section below the articles about the hospital. By now, Richard Tiu has deleted all his own comments, but plenty of other people have already repeated. So Beartown has to find its own sponsors while the council foots the bill in Hyd? Why is there money for Hyd hockey, but not for the hospital? The reporter calls Tiu again. He says modestly that he hasn't been involved in any discussions concerning the hospital and suggests that the reporter might do better to ask the leader of the largest party on the council instead. So the reporter calls him. He answers on his cell phone, on vacation in Spain. The reporter gets straight to the point. Why are you transferring all the council's funding from Beartown Ice Hockey directly to Hyd Hockey? Can't Hyd Hockey find their own sponsors so that the council can invest the money in the hospital instead? Perhaps the politician is too relaxed. Perhaps he's even had a glass of wine. But he replies, Listen, my dear, it's not the same money at all. Surely you can see that. Completely different budgets. As far as hockey is concerned, we're focusing the council's resources where we believe they will do most good. And right now, that's with Hyd Hockey, not Beartown. The reporter quotes him online, but leaves out the word hockey. So now it just says, right now, that's with Hyd, not Beartown. The comments section soon fills up. Ha! As usual, Hyd gets everything. Do they think we don't pay taxes in Beartown or something? Then, like someone said before, why is there money for Hyd hockey, but not for health centers in Beartown? Then, what do politicians think is most important, hockey or health care? The reporter calls the politician in Spain again and asks, what do you think is most important, hockey or the hospital? The politician clears his throat and tries to explain. You can't make simple comparisons like that. But the reporter keeps probing until the politician snaps, surely to God you understand that I think hospitals are more important than hockey. The reporter quotes him directly and provides a few extra words of context. He said, when we contacted him in his summer house in Spain. The article also mentions in passing the fact that the Spanish homeowning politician lives in Hyd rather than in Beartown. When the reporter calls Richard Tiu again to request another interview, Tiu asks if the reporter would mind conducting it in the council building because Tiu is at work all summer. Being a local councillor here isn't a job. It's a privilege, he adds. The next article in the local paper includes a photograph of him alone in the dining room of the council building, hard at work. In response to the question, hockey or health care, he replies, I believe taxpayers deserve a society where we don't have to choose between health care and opportunities for exercise and leisure. Soon another article will appear on the website of the local paper. No one really knows how a summer temp could have dug up a piece of news like this, but suddenly there is documentation to prove that prominent counselors have